have told you this morning, each year following the national conference, I conduct an HMA membership questionnaire, and I ask you, what do you want to learn about? And over the last several years, what do you want to hear more on? One of the main topics has been employee health care benefits and how you can look to give your employees the benefits they deserve but afford to give it to them. So this time around, I've called upon One Digital, a consulting firm that deals with employee benefit administration products and services, and one of HMA's resource purchasing power partners to help us with this pressing issue. One Digital account executive, Michelle Reynolds, has put together a panel comprised of representatives from Guardian, One Digital, and United Healthcare. These healthcare and benefit experts will be discussing employee benefits and healthcare reform, what you're doing and what you should expect. Michelle will serve as panel moderator, and following the panel presentation, she will be conducting one of the roundtable discussions at the industry confab. Please join me in welcoming Michelle Reynolds.
Thank you all for having me. I didn't see a bunch of you walk out the back door, so that's very nice of you. Certainly a fitting welcome. So good afternoon, everyone. As I look out into the audience this afternoon, I see some clients in the audience, some folks I'm talking to about your benefit plans, and most importantly, I see a ton of you who I now call friends. For those of you who have not met yet, my name is Michelle Reynolds, and I work in business development for One Digital. My job is to talk to you at a high level about employee benefits and how to maximize those plans for your company. As a little background on me, I'm from Arizona, and I grew up in a small ranching community in the high country of the state. This area is known for ranching. It's prime hunting, as Mark and Owen will attest to, and it's logwoods. Many don't know that Arizona is home to the largest pine forest in the nation. I have strong family ties to the logging industry. My grandfather worked in the logwoods for Southwest Forest Industries in the 1950s, and he raised my mother and her siblings in a small logging camp called Maverick, which is now a ghost town. When I grew up, the mill was a primary employer in the town, employing many of my relatives, and the mill has since closed because of the spotted owl back in the late 80s. Many in my small town highly regarded the work that they did in the mill. With that said, I have an affinity for the work that you do, and I feel deep personal ties with each of you in this business. Your well-being and the well-being of your employees is important to me because in each one of you, I see the industry that supported my family, and in every one of your employees, I see my relatives that worked in that meal. So with that, today I'm going to grab your hand, and we're going to talk through some of the changes of the Affordable Care Act. We're going to talk about what that means to you as an employer offering benefits. I checked my heart rate right before I got up here, and my Fitbit says it's 168. I tried to take a Xanax, but Robin Little in the back took it from me. So, anyway, the Affordable Care Act was signed into law March 23, 2010. ACA is often referred to by its nickname as Obamacare. Now, I'm pointing this out because often people think these two are not the same thing when, in fact, that they are. The law, when enacted, had broad-reaching implications for individuals and employers alike. And today, this law is poised to change again, as we all well know. As we're speaking today, the U.S. House of Representatives is voting on new health care legislation that, if enacted, will once again change the nature of health care for individuals and also for you. Today, with the help of my esteemed panel here, we're going to talk about health care in general, ACA, and we're going to try to touch on as many of the moving parts as we can, given that we all know that there are no finalized guidelines at this point. We'll try to wrap up the panel and leave enough time for some Q&A afterwards. So before I introduce my panel today, though, I want to first thank Linda for all the hard work in helping coordinate this and for prodding me to get all my deadlines in. And I want to thank the HMA board for very kindly inviting us to speak to you. I would also be remiss if I didn't shoot out a thanks to my business partner, Robin Little with BB&T and his team, for without him, I would not know you all. So now turning to the panel today, we're joined by Wally Dawson up here in the front. Wally is the regional managing principal for One Digital. Wally is a graduate of Penn State University and has worked in employee benefits almost longer than God himself. Holding positions with Prudential, Kaiser Permanente, Aon, and One Digital now for more than 6 years, Wally is my boss. You may remember I just regarded you as my friend, so please make me look good today. Martha Brown is the Director of Small Business Sales for United Healthcare of the South Atlantic, which covers the Carolinas and Georgia. Martha has been working in healthcare for 26 years and has been with United since 1991. Martha is a graduate of George Mason University, holds a BA in government and politics, and is a member of the National Association of Health Underwriters. I don't currently have any jokes about Martha, but the day is still young. Crystal Harris, with One Digital, is my account manager and advisor. She is the key contact for many of you that are my clients. Crystal works with many of the HMA accounts that we have. Crystal has more than 10 years of industry experience, spending 9 of those with BB&T. It is an incestuous industry. Crystal is a graduate of Liberty University. She is my right arm and, without a doubt, smarter than me. I also say she's the only person that can drink more beer than I can. And then lastly, Brad Schumacher. Brad is the executive sales consultant with Guardian Life. Brad has more than 15 years industry experience in providing consultative solutions for products such as dental, vision, life, disability, and other enhanced employee benefits. Brad also does a good deal of work with many companies in the lumber industry, and I've had the pleasure of working very closely with him lately to benchmark many of the products that we introduce to you and that I bring to you personally regularly. Brad is a graduate of Miami University, for which we will forgive him, and is certainly one of the most dapper guys I've ever met. If you guys have seen his dress code, it's pretty awesome. So anyway, let's go ahead and kick this off. So we're reading and hearing in the news a ton about the AHCA. Many of you know that that's the American Healthcare Act, which is the act poised to replace the ACA. So this is a general question for the panel, and we'll start off with Wally. Wally, from your professional perspective, give us an idea of what we might see within the next 24 months from healthcare reform.
Well, I have to say it depends what happens in the next 2 hours on Capitol Hill. Obviously, there's a vote today at 4 o'clock, poising the House to see if the AHCA passes or in what form it does pass. So with the passage of it or without it, I would say in general that the next 24 months, we really expect to see more of the same. And what I mean by that is, you know, even since the passage of the ACA in March 2010, we've had continuous change, implementation, a lot of agencies trying to interpret the law and figure out how to apply it in the local market. And honestly, we don't see that changing going forward for the next 24, really even through looking out into 2020, looking at the some of the provisions that are in the timeline right now. So I think my guidance here would be, you know, prepare for more of the same. It's going to be a changing. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be something that hopefully that there is more attention put on cost control as opposed to access. But time will tell. We'll see what happens hopefully in the next couple of days.
Martha?
I think Wally expressed it exactly right. More of the same, which is some uncertainty and certainly a lot of interpreting of what the law may or may not be. There's even some debate that we even get to a vote at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So things are very dynamic and changing. So I think steady on is probably what I would say in terms of what you all would want to expect in terms of employee benefits.
Brad, anything to add to that?
No, I think they touched on it well. I think change and uncertainty are the words that I think about as it relates to healthcare reform. And you know, today's vote is going to provide some sort of clarity, but it's also a passage that's going to be implemented in 2020 in some respects or 2025. So that could actually lead to a different administration implementing some of the things that pass. And that, of course, will create more uncertainty as well and potential change down the road as well. So I think preparing for change and preparing for uncertainty and having trusted advisors is really where I think we all need to be working together.
Crystal, anything to add?
No surprise, I'm essentially going to echo all the comments because it really and truly it is the unknown and uncertainty. But I think for me the most important comment to make as it relates to this particular question is just being informed and staying informed. As the change occurs, being able to relay that information to you as the groups, as employers, and making sure that you're prepared to adapt as the changes occur. So for me, it's uncertainty and unknown, but just making sure we're on the front end of the information and pass that along as we can.
So I've counted, we've been in this for 2 minutes and we're already on a theme, right? Does everybody catch that? All right. So, Martha, from a carrier's perspective, how will some of these proposed changes affect the carriers in general? And then, of course, you know, you can speak to UHC specifically or UnitedHealthcare specifically.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Really unknown at this point. A lot of what is contained in the Act thus far that we've seen of it really is addressing getting after federal financial pieces. Not so much really huge changes to what employers should expect to cover and therefore what we need to build for our plans. Essential health benefits was a big deal in 2010 when it was part of Obamacare, and that's either on or off the table depending upon literally what hour it is and which member of Congress is speaking to whom. So I think one thing that we hope to see and we think will come out of that is certainly more HSA-type plans, more tax advantageous things to come from that, higher limits. We are certainly preparing for that. We having to file our small business ACA plans, we just finalized those for 2018. So it's kind of crazy. We're in the third month of 2017, brought on new plans for 2017, yet we're having to get ready to submit to the various state departments of insurance, hey, here's what we want to sell and what we think will comply with what may or may not be coming. So it's very dynamic, very changing, and really, again, depending upon what comes out, you know, who's to say.
Yeah. So that time, I mean, it takes a little while for you to put together and anticipate some of the changes. So you're obviously thinking now, you're not thinking about 2017, you're thinking about 2018, 2019. Can you give us a sense of whether or not, from a carrier's perspective, again, you guys are anticipating any changes, and if you're moving some of your plans, plan designs, that sort of thing, to anticipate those changes?
Well, we certainly developed and put out and will be filing many more HSA plan designs. Depending upon what happens with essential benefits, that is one thing that could have a fairly big impact on what plan designs may or may not look like. Everybody will be subject to that, so United won't be terribly unique as far as that's concerned. But we are also making sure that we're continuing to expand programs that we embed with our medical problem, programs such as wellness, integrated wellness, virtual visits, these type of things to help continue and increase the engagement of your employees with their own health and with their health coverage.
Wally, can you tag on to that? And can I also have you address specifically, Martha talked about the essential health benefits. And maybe just for our group, can you talk a little bit about what those essential health benefits are?
Yeah, let me take a step back, but I do want to make a comment about, you know, the impact on the carriers, because I think, you know, ACA, as it's written now, I think everyone's familiar looking across the country and some of the news that we've heard about carriers withdrawing from the individual markets, dropping out of the exchanges, and some of the financial losses that the carriers have experienced due to the regulatory requirements of ACA. So there's no doubt that that regulation and that law has been a huge challenge for the insurance company. So, you know, think about what the law promised them. They said that, you know, in exchange for getting rid of guaranteed issue and certain medical requirements and getting rid of lifetime and different maximums and reducing all these policy provisions, you were going to get more customers that were going to come to you over time because of what the law required for the mandates. And now what's being talked about not only is the individual mandate, but also the employer potential, the employer penalty for not offering a health plan is on the table to remove. So those are the drivers of increasing the pool of potential customers for the insurance companies to give up some of the cost controls that they had built into an underwriting. So those are on the table, and that's a very interesting, if you just look at it from the economics of the policy and what it requires from underwriting, you know, the administration is asking once again the insurance companies to step into the breach, if you would, and take on potentially more risk. And to what degree they're going to continue to do that, I think it's going to be interesting to watch. I would say that, you know, for the majority of the impact of this, it's really going to be in the individual market and the small group market. That's where you're going to see, and by small group, I'm really referring to companies that have less than 50 employees, and then the individual segment. That's where you're going to see a lot of this regulatory impact. Those greater, Now that you're not required to offer, or you're not going to be penalized by not offering a health plan, I think that those who have been offering a compliant plan already, we don't really anticipate to see a lot of change because they understand the value of offering benefits for recruitment and retention of your employees and competitive differential. However, those who have used alternate means to meet that mandate, such as by offering what we refer to as a MEC plan or minimal essential coverage products, those types of products, those are likely to get dropped. Mm-hmm. So, there's potential disruption in the marketplace again. To your question about the essential health benefits, what that meant is that the ACA required that all qualified health plans contain certain provisions in them, such as pediatric dental and certain preventive care and certain types of coverage and benefits had to be included in every single policy. Well, if that's been a driver of health care costs, that's something more requirements of regulations, been more mandated benefits than required to be in the policies, that's obviously driving up cost. If that is to be removed, potentially there is some cost reduction to be gained from that. I don't think that from a medical management or from a utilization standpoint that we've necessarily seen the benefits that those essential health benefits have required in terms of improvement of our health status in society, right? So what's the biggest driver of healthcare costs? It's utilization in our lifestyle behaviors, right? So obesity and those things. And if essential health benefits were to get at those issues, we haven't seen that impact it yet. It's way too early. I remember when the CBO originally did the grading on Obamacare this passed in 2010, they estimated that the first time that there would be a decrease or a movement downward trend. There's never a decrease in healthcare costs. I'm sorry, so I never said that. When there's less increase in healthcare costs, if the economics of ACA were perfectly implemented, would be in 2020. It was the first time, and now that's all off the rails. So, realistically, we're not going to see a diminishing in healthcare trend as we know it today.
And we're going to touch on some wellness issues and that sort of thing here in a minute. Brad, I'm just curious from your perspective, you don't deal specifically with the medical piece of the insurance policies in the same capacity that perhaps Wally and Martha do. But with Guardian, kind of a similar question from that ancillary product perspective, is Guardian and from your experience any of the other carriers doing anything to kind of anticipate some of the changes and get in front of them with additional product selections to help fill some gaps?
Sure. Great question. excuse me, the ACA and the Affordable Care Act really impacted ancillary carriers like Guardian from a couple different perspectives. One, we had to manage costs because we were part of the health insurer fee that was applied. So that became a part of our discussion around renewals and pricing of new business. Small component, but an impact to the ancillary market. Second was the 10 essential health benefits that Wally referenced in pediatric dental. We had to create plan designs pretty quickly that could meet those needs, but then we also had to watch the changing landscape out there as medical carriers began to embed those products into the health plans that you could purchase. And so we spent a lot of time and energy creating those plans, and in some states there's still continued movement towards offering those plans in the private dental market, and in other states medical carriers really just handle that need. So as an ancillary carrier, you kind of have to be nimble enough to handle those two things. Lastly, it's really, as you alluded to, there's, for the ancillary carriers, there's a lot of opportunity within ACA and health plans, and that's in the form of other product segments that maybe carriers weren't involved in. So Guardian, as an example, we really weren't a part of the individual dental and vision market prior to ACA. We've invested heavily in diversifying our organization from that perspective. As employees buy coverage on exchanges, we also want to have opportunities for people to buy dental, for example. Another way is we see a trend based on our research that employers are more highly considering self-funding their health insurance plans, and smaller employers are considering that. So we actually entered the stop-loss market, and other ancillary carriers have followed suit. And so the benefit for you as an employer is that stop-loss market now has more markets that brokers like One Digital can go to, which creates a more competitive environment and obviously lower costs for you long-term. And then the last piece is really around what some carriers call supplemental health benefits and other carriers call worksite benefits or voluntary benefits. And those are plans like gap plans, hospital indemnity, accident and critical illness. And so there's a lot of opportunity for insurance companies to offer your employees those products as well, and we're going to touch on those, I think, a little bit later in the discussion as well.
That's right. So at the roundtable, after we're done with the panel this afternoon, I believe we are going to stay here in this ballroom area. So if any of you are interested in digging into any of these topics on a more specific, more granular level, please join us, and we'll do that. So we've been talking a little bit about and sort of framing this conversation, I think, very high level from what we're seeing with respect to this proposed legislation. How it will impact the carriers. And I'm just kind of curious if we can maybe take this down from 30,000 feet to about 1,000, and can we talk about perhaps how some of these changes may directly impact the companies in this room? And Wally, will you kick that one off?
Yeah, certainly. So just to start with, you know, the primary focus of the AHCA, as it's now being referred, is really around the individual product and federal spending on Medicare and on Medicaid. That's where you're seeing a lot of the, you know, a lot of the politics of what's going to happen today on today's votes are going to be around what the law, for example, there's a proposal under state expansion of Medicaid, whether or not that's a block grant and whether or not there's a work requirement that's imposed of it. So that really doesn't have anything to do with the employer market, but it has a lot to do with federal spending. So I think from a corporate perspective, as an employer, the primary issue that's on the table is the relief of the employer penalty for noncompliance would be eliminated under the law that's proposed right now. So, as you probably know, they passed ACA, what we refer to as the Reconciliation Act. So, the only way they can when we talk about the action that Congress can take today, it's really only on those things that impact revenue, not in terms of the policy issues themselves. So that's what they're going to go after. They're going to go after the penalties. They're going to go after the mandates. They're going to go after the subsidies, those things that have revenue attached to them. So for the employer, that potentially means that the penalties for not being compliant with the law are going to be retroactively eliminated back to 2017. So the law doesn't go, the requirement, the mandates don't come off the book, just the penalty for not complying with them will be implemented. And then for employees, it's the same. The individual mandates there that have driven up some of the enrollment of your employees in your health plans is because now employees have a mandate to have coverage. Well, that also is proposed to be eliminated, the penalty of that. So those two issues are really foremost what we're going to see front line in terms of the employees or the employer's immediate impact.
Yeah. Martha, you agree with that? I see you shaking your head.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, again, depending upon what may come in, come out, change, another thing that could potentially have some immediate effect is depending upon what taxes get repealed and when.
Crystal, what about you? You deal with the employees every single day. You're probably hearing some of what they're watching on television. Maybe you can kind of key us into what you're hearing out there with the employees.
Sure. I think from a direct impact to employees, again, taking it not quite down to the nitty-gritty granular level, still at a 1,000-foot level, some of the impact that we'll see is, to Wally's point, the penalties, but from an employee standpoint, I'm having a lot of conversations as I'm doing employee meetings. In fact, I had one last week. Gentleman came up to me and said, well, do I really even need to enroll? The bill's out there, probably not going to have any penalties. And my conversation with them has always been, you know, don't make your decisions based on what we have today, not what you think might be tomorrow. So while the bill's been introduced, it's not necessarily been approved. But there certainly is a lot of conversation, a lot of just water cooler talk amongst the employees. So the best thing I do and what I try to do is just make sure, again, that they're completely informed and they make the decision, arm them with the information, let them make the decisions as to the penalties, whether they decide to accept them or what have you. Another point that I think that a direct impact, if the legislation goes through that's in the bill, is on the FSA contribution limits. That is something that I think will directly impact employees. Right now, the maximums are $2,600 for health and $5,000 for dependent care. And if the opportunity is to remove those, that might afford some employees additional opportunities, tax savings ways to think about out-of-pocket expenses and so forth. So just conversation is definitely out there. Your employees are hearing it. They're seeing it in the media. They're not shy about asking about it. So I would say just be upfront and informative and let them know what you're hearing and seeing, because I think they really do care, and they're taking notice. They're watching.
Yep. So just to kind of put a fine point on it, diverging from the script a little bit, the employer mandate in place today, Wally, compliance? Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
Yes. So we are saying do not comply with the employer mandate today. Individual mandate?
Still the law.
Still the law. That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I was talking to some lumber guys, at a club meeting last week, and we were discussing controlling health care costs. And one of the guys, and I won't say his name, he might be in here somewhere, his response was, there's no such thing as control. We're at the mercy of the carriers of the market and the market. Those of us that work in insurance, we talk a lot about how we assist our clients in controlling many of these costs and some of the things that we have in our power to control costs. Maybe each of you can talk a little bit about your strategy specifically to help the folks in this room control costs at a time when many feel exactly the way this person does. David.
So I'll kick that off. I mean, this is actually kind of a, in some ways, a little bit of a frustrating conversation for us and our benefit and what we do in our industry, because, you know, absolutely the management of the healthcare budget for you is something that you can proactively impact. And for anybody to sit back and say, well, we're at the mercy of the insurance companies, the providers, and things that are outside of our control, so, you know, we're just going to react to the trend increase or whatever we're getting, that is really, I think, is a very short-sighted answer, because there's a lot of opportunities. And what I would encourage everyone to, when you look at your healthcare spend and what you're doing and the programs you offer your employees, is you really need to take a risk management approach to your employee, your health care coverage, just like you would for your workers' comp or other liability you have. It is a risk. The financial exposure you have as an employer is a risk. And so there's things that you can proactively do to manage that risk. So if we go back to what's the primary driver of health care costs, it's utilization and it's the health and the behaviors of our employees. That's where we can make an impact. All right? So what are you doing in terms of your plan design selection that's appropriate for your employees? What are you doing in terms of the types of funding mechanisms that you're using and the risk that you're willing to take in order to drive that? What are you doing to incent your employees or to mandate that your employees are doing certain things like preventive health care or doing enrolling in certain products in order to help manage their risk? The way to did, you know, when we put the biggest driver of healthcare costs, which is employees, the consumer, and their spouses and dependents on the sidelines of decision making, and saying, we're going to buy this plan for you and we're going to do everything we need for you. You just go to continue to use care, but we're not going to require anything of you. Mm-hmm. You have, if you really want to get in the game of managing costs, you have to engage the consumer. You have to engage the consumer in what their discretionary healthcare spend is, and how can they change their behaviors individually to a higher health status. And there's lots of different ways to do that, you as an employer. But I think it starts with changing the thought paradigm of it being an unmanageable cost that you have no impact on to something you really have to approach as a risk management liability. And that's what we try to help our clients do.
Martha, can you, just to piggyback on that question, can you talk a little bit about that? You know, I feel like many of our clients here and many prospective clients that we have here in the audience and just employers in general are a little reticent to get into that integrated wellness piece of their employees, feeling like that's a stretch of, you know, your contract between you as an employer and your employees. I know you want, you know, them to manage themselves. So can you maybe talk about how you would approach that from UnitedHealthcare's perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. And so Wally did a great job laying that out and being able to engage your employees in making better decisions, personally making better decisions, because believe it or not, that's really the one main thing that drives a majority of cost for care is just the bad choices many of us make in terms of not exercising, eating wrong, smoking, what have you.
Did I mention beer?
Say what?
Did I mention beer?
Except for beer. I would really point out two things from a plan design standpoint. So I think it would be prudent for anybody to make sure that they're taking a really good hard look, and I'm going to get to your what you want me to answer, but
yes.
He made me think about this. Get to looking at your specific benefits and really take a look and see, A, what does your emergency room benefit look like? Is it a $50 copay? Because 70% of visits to either the urgent care, the emergency room, are really things that could be handled in an office visit or even with a virtual visit. So that's kind of shocking, or it should be. And also having virtual visits available. And so not that I know a whole lot about your industry, but I think I know enough about it to know that the ability for people to connect with a physician either via their smartphone, their computer at home, or their regular telephone at home can really help with productivity and less absenteeism. So there's two specific things I would look at in terms of plan design. And then moving on to wellness, and so if you can find a situation where you can have integrated wellness, you can introduce to your employees a venue for them to take ownership of their health by encouraging them to walk. So I'm going to talk about Motion, which Michelle is very familiar with. It's one of the programs that we embed in several of our plans, and it really ties to a little tracker. So I don't know if you are wearing a little fitness tracker in the room. Raise your hand. Okay. Are we the only five people in here wearing a fitness tracker? Okay. So this might be a really great thing for y'all to take back. So let me give you a statistic or two. So for a person who walks less than 2,000 steps in a day, they have greater than $10,000 in healthcare costs in a year.
Wow.
So if you walk less than 2,000 steps in a day's time, you are going to have greater than $10,000 in healthcare costs. If you're a person that walks between 2,000 and 4,000 steps, you can cut that in half. So you can mitigate that. You can get to, you're generally probably going to be around $5,000 in annual healthcare costs. But if you can get to 8,000 steps or more, that cost drops to $3,000. So there's some really good and specific statistics tied to having an integrated program. And in this case, I'm talking about a walking program. And it's with our Motion product, we actually provide trackers to the your employees. And they wear them around, and they all they can go and compete against each other. I'm sure you've had clients that have done that, Michelle,
mm-hmm.
Set up competitions among themselves. But the idea is to really encourage them to walk, and in terms of frequency, at least walking six times a day for 5 minutes, intensity, so walking 3,000 steps in a 30-minute time period, and then if you can achieve 10,000 steps in a day. So if you look at those three targets, a person can significantly reduce the amount of healthcare cost expenditure that they should have. And in turn, that's good for you, right? So helps with productivity, absenteeism, and certainly helps to get after that healthcare cost, as Wally talked about, that really a large driver of it is personal decision making and whether what we eat or don't eat and whether we exercise or don't exercise. So we're able to have that embedded in many of our plans. It's really very turnkey. We find a lot of times employees really like it because they like to compete sometimes against each other. So you'll see people walking all kinds of places to make sure that they're hitting their statistics for the day. And what happens in turn for people who are successful in this is they actually can earn up to $3 in a day. So if you hit that frequency, that intensity, and the total steps guidelines, you can earn up to $3 in a day that we credit into an employee's account that goes towards their out-of-pocket costs for the year from their health insurance plan. So they can earn back about $1,100 in credit towards their out-of-pocket costs. So it has a very real monetary benefit as well to the employee, because not only are you going to get a benefit from it, but they certainly are going to see a benefit from it if they're able to achieve those guidelines.
More moving, less claims, less cost to you. It's important, right? Brad, anything to add to that?
I think, you know, there's an industry trend around really financial wellness, and I'm going to maybe take a little different approach than what Wally and Martha did. But on the ancillary side, we spent a lot of time doing research about employee trends, buying trends, employee education and communication, and financial wellness has become really the hot topic. And what we're finding is most employees make most of their financial decisions at the workplace. They don't generally get called on by an individual life insurance agent. They don't generally get called on by a financial planner, maybe because they don't have the investable assets, maybe just because whatever reason. And so you as an employer are beginning to carry this kind of unspoken responsibility of you're the actual source for an employee and we're the source of the product for them to make their financial decisions. And so as Martha alluded to, being very careful with your plan designs and how you make changes and using those changes to control costs, we've created our hospital indemnity plans and our accident plans and our critical illness plans. And those help fill the gaps that employees have. And that's one facet of their financial wellness. And so as we continue to try to control costs, and the trend has been that deductibles and out-of-pocket costs increase, it's really important that you as an employer sit down with an advisor and really analyze those plans. And then more importantly than that, take the time to actually give employees time to be educated about those plans. I think the biggest challenge in the whole financial wellness picture and in the benefits communication picture right now is that we all offer plans, but then we give people 30 minutes to go through what really needs to be 2 hours of content. And unfortunately, employees get confused. They may make a bad buying decision. Maybe they buy too much, or they don't buy anything because they don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't help them in their overall financial wellness picture. So a little different approach, but just I think it's something that in all of our trends we've seen. So I'll close my comments by saying in one of our workplace benefits studies that we just released, we polled employees with less than 5 years, or sorry, in the first 5 years of their career, and then employees with 5 years left before retirement. And in both of those subsets of the employee population that we studied, they told us that they want more help and they want more time to understand their benefits. And if you think about those two subsets of the population, they're very different needs, right? One set is planning retirement. They may need more help on what options they have on their 401k, for example, or another subset of that. The others are trying to figure out, okay, how do I buy disability insurance and how do I buy life insurance and how do I really get that foundation set? So those are some of the things from the ancillary perspective that we can try to help do as well.
Sure. So, Crystal, with respect to controlling costs, you know where this is what we're practical advice to our employers in the room. What do you think?
Yeah, so there's been a very consistent theme about what drives majority of the cost, which is somebody hollered out. What's driving, do it? Well, utilization, right? So just utilizing them in claims. So part of my job and my role as an account manager is to really have my finger on the pulse of what may be driving some of that claims cost. A lot of our carriers do have the ability to produce reporting at a deeper level with some of the level funding, such as All Savers through United Healthcare. And what that allows us to do is potentially pick up on trends at an earlier point as opposed to waiting to renewal or after a major claim. So let's say, for example, if we're looking at your claims that comes on a monthly basis and we see a spike in emergency room or we see, you know, there's a lot of prescription drugs and very few of them are at a generic level, then we take a step back and we have some conversation. Okay, how do we address this? How do we overcome this? Maybe it's a communication to the employees on utilizing emergency room in lieu of primary care. That's not the way to go. Lunch and learn. So, I mean, it's really about educating the employees, but for the employer level, it's really managing that claims, managing that risk, in addition to all the other wellness and so forth. But we do have that capability to do that at a greater level, and I've seen it pay off, and I think it's important that we continue to look at that as being a solution for controlling some of the costs. From an employee standpoint, helping your employees manage their costs, a lot of that comes in just properly educating them on the plans that they have and the benefits that they have available to them. So when I'm doing the meetings or I'm having one-on-ones or having conversations with the employees, it's, you know, when you're going to the doctor and he prescribes a medication, don't be scared to ask your doctor, can I get a generic? I think you would rather pay $10 for generic versus $60 for brand. So just coaching the employees, kind of the tricks of the trade, so that they can get the biggest bang for their buck. I typically always go through the benefits, what's in network, what's out of network. Okay, employees, why is out of network more expensive? Well, there's a reason to it. There's deeper discounts and so forth and so on. So we're trying to drive you in network. That's where your benefits pay the most, and you'll have less out of pocket. So it's just really educating the employees, helping them understand the different value-added services, but really give them the tricks to manage their benefits, and hopefully at the end of the day, they're coming out a lot less out of pocket than they would have if they'd have just gone with the prescription the doctor provided. So I think from that standpoint, it's really just about education and helping them understand their benefits.
Yes.
Michelle, I just wanted to add something. When Crystal was speaking, it reminded me of something. When we talk about this strategy, this question started with what can employers do to control healthcare costs, right? And, you know, one of the things that we had a product a few years ago we introduced. It was a defined benefit called a DBM product. But it basically what it did, what I want to talk about, is introducing choice to your employees when you have multiple products your employees can choose from. And there was an interesting statistic that after looking at the enrollment in private exchanges, employers that offer choice, that when given the option, when an employee had a choice of buying down their benefits, meaning paying less money to receive less benefits, 67% of employees bought down their benefit option. So what does that mean? That means that most likely, if you offer a single plan health benefit program to your employees, that 67% of your employees are overinsured and you're paying a premium on a product in which that's really not what they want. If you gave them a choice of buying down to a different product or receiving a financial incentive to do something else in terms of their selection, that they would take that option. So again, another strategy here, but getting back to employee engagement, educating them, giving them choice, and managing it from a risk standpoint, there are absolutely things you can do to help control your healthcare spend.
So many of us in this room were here this morning, I think, and I feel like we're sort of circling the wagons here. Many of us heard the HR folks this morning suggest that meetings with your employees, one-on-ones, to talk about important things like benefits, drives employee satisfaction and drives higher retention within your organizations, right? So Crystal's saying essentially the same thing, meeting one-on-one with your employees to go through this important life selection with their benefits is really very important. So thank you for that. Thanks, Wally. Brad, I want to dig into this a little bit with you, just again from the perspective of Guardian and the ancillary plans. How are you seeing, or can you talk a little bit about how you're filling in some of the cost and care gaps for employers, especially now as we're hearing more about AHCA and we're hearing more about perhaps proposed increases in deductibles on some of the plans and driving many employers and employees to HSA plans? Can you talk a little bit about how Guardian may be reacting to that?
Sure. Well, the trend has been since really the passage of ACA originally and now certainly with the AHCA, deductibles rising over the last 5 or plus years. And that's caused a lot of out-of-pocket costs for employees. And as those employees face that, what we're seeing the trend become is that one of the top concerns around bankruptcies is a matter of an employee who had health insurance who goes bankrupt due to a health condition. And so as a result, all of the carriers, including Guardian, have created products that help meet that need. So the original product that was out there really was the accident insurance plan. And you as an employer really have to think about how you offer a plan like that. Do you want it to be on and off the job or just off the job? You have to think about your workers' compensation as you're making that decision and what people would do. But that product is confined to a set schedule. And that's a good product to offer, but it still leaves some potential gaps within the plan. So the overarching theme is that employees have out-of-pocket costs for all the different things they have, and they have deductibles and they have co-insurance and an out-of-pocket plan of maybe $5,000. And they can fill that with some type of HSA contribution, but then an accident plan can help them for specific items. The next kind of product that caught a lot of interest was the critical illness plan and the cancer plans. and critical illness kind of moved the market away from a cancer plan that worked exactly like an accident plan that had a schedule of benefits and really migrated more to a lump sum, right? So many of those people that I referenced that were in the bankruptcy didn't have a huge burden of debt. It's just that most employees don't have $5,000 sitting around, and as a result, that created financial hardship. So critical illness policies created lump sum benefits for heart attack, for example, or a stroke, included cancer, and it became a more cost-effective measure to offer those types of plans. The real interesting trend has been on hospital indemnity plans, and we've seen a big rise in interest in hospital indemnity plans, and we've seen some employers get creative with actually offering those plans on an employer-funded basis in some situations, and maybe offering a base level of care that they provide or that you provide as an employer, and combine that with some funding of a HSA or an HRA or some form of account, rather than just fully funding those accounts. And you can actually save on your overall dollars perspective by integrating a strategy like that, and then giving employees the opportunity to purchase a richer plan than what you're going to provide. And that seems to be a really cost-effective strategy. The other thing we see is high participation in the voluntary aspect of that plan, because when an employee understands that you sponsor the plan as an employer and you think it's important, they naturally have a higher participation rate. So those are some kind of granular strategies around those product sets. Again, it goes back to my comment about financial wellness, though. If you're going to invest in or make the decision to go down that path with those types of products, it's really critical that you give employees the opportunity to understand those products and not have them kind of be glossed over at the end of an enrollment meeting.
Right.
Because employees aren't going to make the decision that they might need to make because they don't understand it generally. The other thing that we see a huge trend in based on some of the studies we've done is around the industry really making these products a lot more simpler in the offerings. And so it used to be that carriers would create a product and just have unlimited number of choices, and that's showing to be ineffective. So I wouldn't be surprised if your advisor or if Michelle brings to you an option that has two choices for an employee, a high and a low. We found that that's more effective for an employee to understand it, and you can engage in a better discussion around that product. And then most importantly, how it actually interrelates with their medical plan and the out-of-pocket costs that they would face with that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Working side by side with the medical plan, not as a forgotten on the back burner.
Absolutely.
Like it. Okay. So we have a lot of moving parts in employee benefits right now, as all y'all can tell. With the proposed changes to health care reform, many markets are trying to anticipate what this Congress is going to do. All of us are, you know, keeping a very close eye on what's happening. As we've talked about today, carriers are trying to fill the gaps, and you all and your employees right now, I'm sure it feels like you're just white-knuckling it, right? Wally, can you talk a little bit about the role that a broker will play in this time of shifts and uncertainty and perhaps the importance of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just as, you know, I think that the ACA has impacted a lot of different industries, hospitals, providers. You know, it's had a huge impact on our industry in terms of being consultants and advisors to employers. And what's driven that has been the expectations, the demands that employers need. And it's at an all-time high. And you look at the things that you need help with in order to navigate the law from being compliant, but not just from a compliance standpoint, but also from a healthcare and cost management standpoint. So our industry has changed dramatically, and the role of the advisor or consultant in helping you, I really think about it as three primary buckets. You know, you have to have someone who's an advocate for you, and that's having the resources to, on the legislative side, to understand the law and how to interpret it and how to apply it locally and be your advocate in that process. Second is probably the most important is the tools and resources that we as advisors can provide to our employers are at an all-time high for demand, whether it be analytics, whether it be education, whether it be compliance tools, you know, technology platforms, just the resources that we have to be able to be knowledgeable about and be able to help you with are extremely high. And the last thing I would say, kind of, you know, so the third bucket there is expertise. And You know, our industry and helping to guide employers have become very, very technical in terms of the types of products and how to find really the best solution. So, you know, we've had to really up our game, if you would, in terms of the knowledge, expertise, and what we can help guide our clients with. So those are the three main buckets I would suggest.
Those should be the litmus for what somebody in here looks for in a broker.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't, you know, it's amazing the consolidation that's happened in our industry and the number of players that have exited our industry just because of not being able to get that next level of what employers are expecting today. Mm-hmm. And rightfully so, because you all need that help, and you know your advisor is supposed to be your trusted advisor, and really to have that knowledge, expertise, and capability to help you.
Crystal, you want to add to that?
I think just from a working within the vertical, and in particular you guys, being able to establish service norms and being able to really be consistent in that delivery is key, and from where I sit, it's actually not that I have any clients that are favored over another, but when I have the opportunity to work within a particular vertical, really being able to transfer the commonalities and perfecting it along the way is fun for me. And that may sound weird, but it just is. I guess that's why I'm in the seat I'm in. But certainly each group is unique. But what you're faced with a lot of times are very similar challenges. So I would say that being able to see that and be able to apply things that's specific to one group to the other groups is huge. It's beneficial. For example, and I'll just kind of give you a couple of examples and then we can move on. But some of the commonalities that I would say would be, again, and I've said this more than once, is the employee meetings and making sure we're having the proper and appropriate conversations. A lot of you have shift workers, so how do we accommodate shifts? How do we talk to employees without hurting production and so forth? So that's a lot of stuff that we're prepared and adapted to be able to handle and maintain. Hispanic population, we see a lot of that. We have the ability, you know, a lot of times they can speak broken English or they can understand some English. But the reality is they're a whole lot more comfortable in their own language, in Spanish. So we provide the resources to be able to do that. Bringing affordable products to the table. Again, these are all things that are consistent across the board, especially with you guys, carriers that are willing to bring something to the table. For a lot of your employees, a dollar is a dollar, and it's very impactful. So being able to get the most out of that dollar is important. Educating the employees on what that dollar can get them, making sure they're not, to Brad's point, the voluntary benefits, it's not just glossed over, but you're also not overselling it. You want to make sure they don't become insurance poor. So I think it's having those conversations. Claims reviews, that's consistent across the board. How do we drive lower utilization through claims reviews? And just behavioral norms that we've already touched on, wellness and so forth. So that would be my recommendation and my conversation around the working specifically with an employer and so forth. So.
Thanks, Crystal. Brad, the significance of a good broker relationship, how does that impact Guardian?
Yeah, great question. I think in today's benefits world, the broker partner has not been more important than now. I mean, you have so many things on your plate as an employer to manage in your own business, and then you think about the benefits landscape of trying to remain compliant, trying to control costs, trying to keep up with all of the carrier rules based on the carriers you've selected. The broker partner becomes, you know, very, very important in carrier selection, having leverage with that carrier. I've been on the carrier side my entire career. And what I've always found is the brokers that continue to grow and the brokers that continue to gain that trust from clients are the ones that are solving problems that aren't occurring now but could occur down the road.
Right.
And having that long-term thought process and doing benchmarking and working closely with the carrier partners to understand what impacts and what things they're working on in the future as well is critically important. And I think if your broker's not talking to you about that now, then you should ask them that, and I think that's a good way to evaluate what your broker's doing for you versus, you know, every broker can bring a competitive cost, no question about it. but it's how much consultation they're really bringing to the table each day. And as a carrier partner, we see that because, you know, we don't want to write a client and then lose them a year or two later to another carrier that can come in with a better cost. And we need our broker partners to help employers be educated about the utilization on our dental plan or the utilization on our disability plan and what that means and what a carrier change could mean and how longevity with a carrier can actually create a lot of consistency for employees and can actually control costs long term by having that long, stable relationship. So in today's world, the broker partner is critically important, no question.
Martha, same question to you.
Yeah, and Brad did a really eloquent job of describing that. And for us at United Healthcare, it's the same thing. I mean, we really look for, and we do call them partners, broker partners. They are folks that, you know, we will try and find outside-of-the-box solutions for. We will make sure they can really well articulate our product and our value story, and we know that they can articulate their own for many of those things that both Wally and Brad just pointed out. It is a really big differentiator, and there is a lot of variability. I have seen a lot of variability, even still with all the consolidation that's happening within the marketplace for brokers and agents. But there's still a spectrum of here and here. And
just to be sure, and many in the back can't see.
Oh yeah, you
can't.
I'm
here
sorry.
And here.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Vanna White. But it is critical because especially for the smaller employer, there's just so much. There's just so much that is involved, and you need a trusted partner who is very well educated on it, has all the kind of resources that they can bring to the table to help support you and keep you not worrying about that because you can entrust it to them.
Thank you. Thanks, panel. I appreciate it. So as we wrap up here, my last question to all the members of the panel is this, and I hope this is all very beneficial for you all out there, is I'd like to for these folks to walk away this afternoon with a tip or a takeaway that you can give to them that they feel like they can practically use walking out of this room today as it deals with their employee benefit programs. So, Brad, you haven't started yet. Brad, you start out on this one.
Okay. Well, I'm going to probably sound like a beating the same drum the whole time, but I think because we spend so much time in the ancillary space thinking about communication and education, I would say as a tip is maybe reflect on how you handle employee enrollment today. Talk to your broker, talk to Michelle about solutions that can be provided to maybe make that a more effective process and really focus on and understand employees' financial wellness decisions. Many of them are making all those decisions within the confines of your four walls.
Mm-hmm. Wally?
I would leave you with two things. First of all is you should think really hard about how you can engage your employees in being better healthcare consumers and decision makers and what you're doing for your costs. So number one is employee engagement. And number two is thinking about how you manage your healthcare costs as a risk management process as opposed to something that's outside of your control and you're simply writing a check for. That's absolutely not the case. There's things that you can effectively do to impact that, and you got to change the paradigm in terms of it's a risk, it's a liability, how do you get after it?
Martha?
Yeah, and so how fitting that I'm in between these two because I would say if you don't have a wellness program, you really want to start talking to your broker or your agent about how they may be able to help you with that. And that really gets after the piece that Wally was just talking about and making sure you're getting your employees engaged. And, you know, I think wellness programs might scare some people sometimes maybe smaller employers. You know, it doesn't have to be something amazing that Coca-Cola is doing for all their employees. There's many levels, and it just requires taking that first step. And so that is a really great way. Helping people engage with their own health and their own choices is a very impactful way to help control your costs. And then to support what you just said is and making sure that we're taking the time to talk to the employees about it and they understand what the value is to them, not like, oh, my God, my employer wants me to start walking 10,000 steps a day. I don't have time for that. You know, I mean, there's so many different ways to get after that. So,
okay. Crystal?
So I think we've thrown a lot at you, but I would say probably my biggest takeaway for you guys would be just to simply be open-minded. be open to changes and having conversation about the different strategies and solutions that are brought to the table, whether it's, you know, wellness, voluntary benefits, technology. What worked 2 years ago certainly is not going to work this year, and what even worked last year may not work this year. So I would just say be open-minded, welcome those conversations, engage those conversations with your broker partner. Certainly if, you know, have the conversations with myself or Michelle or whoever your current partner is, but definitely be open-minded, because I think there's a lot of solutions and a lot of answers out there that probably people aren't either comfortable with or in the past would have never even thought through it. So.
And just sort of a self-serving add to this, I would say that many of those conversations you want to be having with your partners prior to your renewal. Many of your renewals are due 60 days prior to the, you know, the beginning of your new plan year. You want to be having these conversations at least, I would say, at least 6 months before your renewal, but very possibly no later than 4 or 5 months for your renewal. There is nothing more difficult for you from a stress perspective than to try to be renewing a policy and also try to be integrating some of the more strategic portions of the things we've been talking about here today. So just a thought. So with that, we have some time here. I thought I'd go ahead and open it up to any questions that you all may have. Yes, sir.
You all mentioned fitness tools to use for our employees, and I thought that was excellent, and we're going to move forward with that. Another thing that you mentioned a couple of times was virtual visits. Mm-hmm. And that's a new subject to me and maybe some of us here. Could you talk to us some about what is a virtual visit? How do we make that benefit available to our employees? And is it something like we could have a program, we will pay for 5 virtual visits for each employee or something along those lines?
And if I can, before you take that, Martha, let me just repeat that for everybody in the back. I know this morning we had some questions in the front that folks in the back couldn't hear. He's asking specifically about virtual visits and how those are utilized within a company. So, Martha, I saw you shaking your head. Go ahead.
Thank you, and that's a really great question. So I appreciate the time to expound on it a little bit. And it's actually fairly new to UnitedHealthcare. It's just been about a year that we started introducing that within our product portfolio. Essentially, what virtual visits do is allow your employees to have a doctor's visit over their smartphone or over their computer. Utilizing either FaceTime if you're an Apple person or any of the other type of programs that are out there that allow two-way communication. And so we have a network of physicians in all 50 states that are there and on call and take and conduct office visits, right? They're not truly office visits, hence the region, the nomenclature for virtual, but it is just like an office visit. So, you know, if you get home from work and it's 8 o'clock and your 3-year-old is screaming because their ear hurts, well, you're probably pretty sure they have an ear infection, but you know what, are you going to have to wait and go to the pediatrician in the morning? Can you go to urgent care? Is it still open? Or can you utilize a virtual care visit where you get on your computer or just hold in your smartphone or your tablet and have a consultation with the physician who can actually go, yes, let me look. Yes, what are the symptoms? Okay, let me prescribe. Go ahead and prescribe an antibiotic for you. And so you can get ahead of that very quickly. There is any number of reasons that these virtual physicians can see people for. And so it certainly helps people off shift work, right? So depending upon what shift you're working, you're not really, it's not easy for you probably to get out and get to the physician. So we, as I mentioned, at United just recently started embedding these. We are increasing their prevalence within the various and sundry plans that we offer. I would encourage you to speak to your current carrier and ask them, is that something that they have integrated or not? And or talk to your broker about it within wherever your particular geographic region is. Hopefully your broker will have a really good idea of if any carriers there are offering this type of a service.
I think that's really important because many of us would acknowledge not all of your employees like going to see a doctor, right? I'm in your offices a lot, and I hear that repeatedly, that your folks sometimes put off going to see the doctor for something that in a week or 2 weeks gets severely worse, and obviously then we're driving higher claims dollars on your plan. So anybody else want to take anything on
that?
Yeah,
let me build upon that. So, these virtual visits or teledoc is another terminology for these products. They're not always embedded Sometimes they can be non-embedded solutions in a vendor relationship that we can put in place with a given carrier. And what's really dynamic about, so let me just expand upon, you know, so not all, as you can imagine, not all doctor's visits can be done virtually. There's some, specifically, they will not do any pediatrics below 2 years of age, I believe. They do not prescribe any narcotics. But about, I forget the exact number, but about 65% of our primary care office visits can be done virtually. So if you can take that spend, so let's talk about that from a cost control perspective. If you can take that spend out of your healthcare budget from the carrier's perspective and put it on a flat per diem, for example, a $5 PMPM for your employees, you've taken 65% of your primary care visits out of your what you're paying for through your health insurance carrier. You know, it can have a dramatic impact not only on your employees in terms of having access to care, but also in terms of the premium impact from your carrier. So it's a really it's a dynamic you know, innovation that's really started to become more popular in the last probably 2 years, 3 years, and now the carriers are starting to embed them with their products, as Martha indicated. But
yeah, and I'll add some juice on top of your 65. So according to the Wellness Council of America, last year is actually 70% of emergency visits, urgent care visits, or doctor's visits that can actually be handled telephonically or via a virtual connection. So
all right. So in a way that would work if they had the application on their phone, and they would simply, you preload it with your pharmacy information and your credit card payment, that type of thing. You simply dial it. We have that at our company. We have an employee who seems to always have a sick child, and she will, on her way to work, will have a virtual visit with her doctor and drive through the pharmacy and pick up the child's prescription and not miss a minute of work. So think about that from an employee relations perspective, you offering that. And not only you're saving them time, but for them personally, the convenience of not having to sit in a doctor's office and all of that, huge uptick in morale. So
I just want to clarify, while I said the word PM earlier, that's per member per month. So if anybody had any question about that. Anybody else want to take that? No? Okay. Any other questions? Yes. So the question is, under the new proposed regulations, AHCA, I think we might have touched on possibly purchasing insurance across state lines. So he's asking for a finer point on that.
Yeah, so let me just, as I mentioned earlier, the tactic that the current Congress has to take to change the ACA is only through the Reconciliation Act is the only vehicle they have available to them. And there's only certain provisions of the law that they can really take impact on, specifically those are revenue enhancements, as a congressional term is, penalties, taxes, those types of things. What you're talking about is a regulation issue that would require a second, a whole different congressional bill to pass that. And let me, because I think there's a big myth around this selling across state lines. There's not a prohibition from an insurance carrier to go into any state and to try and if they want to offer you a healthcare product in a given state. Let me give you the state of North Carolina, where I'm from, for example. UnitedHealthcare, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, obviously, Cigna, Aetna, those are our primary carriers. So what keeps the other carriers, let's use Humana as an example, what keeps Humana from coming to North Carolina to sell insurance? Is it because there's a law that says that they can't cross state lines? No. It's because they have to comply with the North Carolina DOI requirements, which are not difficult at all, but more importantly, they have to gain market share. They have to go in there and they have to, it's a market-driven solution, so they have to go in there. It's, you know, so Humana's looking at North Carolina and saying, it's not worth us going in to the North Carolina right now, so we decide not to. So I think really understanding when advocates throw that out in terms of, you know, what would the ability to sell across state lines really do in terms of healthcare costs? I don't give it a lot of credit in terms of how it will drive down. It's more of a regulatory relief for the insurance companies than it will do in terms of driving down cost. Because if, you know, what that essentially means, if I'm an insurance company and I'm in Texas, and I want to sell my policies that are filed in Texas and North Carolina, that I have the ability to do that. That's what selling across state lines would do without having to comply with the state regulation. I can just go in there and take my Texas-approved plan and sell it in North Carolina. Well, that Texas-approved plan is built upon a premium from a healthcare perspective that's based on the negotiations that that provider will be able to achieve in the local market. Mm-hmm. They don't have that deal, if you would, from a local market in North Carolina. So the premium that's going to be required to drive to sell that policy in North Carolina is not the same as it is in Texas. So I just point that out because that, you know, that's oftentimes cited as a driver of healthcare costs. It's really a regulatory issue. Because if an insurance company, if that Texas-based insurance company wanted to go to North Carolina and negotiate directly with the providers and get an effective and get a competitive premium, they could do that today.
That's right. Yep. Okay. Yes.
Just wondering, you know, you go to the hospital and you come back and you get a bill there that says your cost is $475, but your provider has negotiated with the hospital and it's only $75 to get it. Does somebody who does not have insurance actually pay that $475?
So the question to the back of the room there is, you go to the doctor, you get a big bill back from the doctor, and under your explanation of benefits, it says your insurer has already pre-negotiated with that carrier down to a $75 bill. Martha, how about you take that one?
Yeah, thank you. Just one correction. He was asking about a hospital bill, but, I mean, really it could apply to either. So in theory, yes, they would receive a bill at that $475 amount that you referenced. What really happens, probably dependent upon how savvy or not that person who doesn't have insurance is and their ability to pay or not pay. Certainly for folks who may not have any other coverages, maybe indigent somewhat, some gets written off, or for others, they will negotiate like on just a one-time basis with a particular person, hoping they'll get a little bit of something rather than nothing and having to go to court and chase money.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
In an environment where you have a company where people go to work at 6 a.m., work 10 or 12 hours, rural environment, what type of, where do you use the program where you get people involved?
Oh, wellness. So, like, okay. So the question is, for folks that are in more rural areas, which is most of y'all out there, right? So folks more rural, what's a good strategy for engaging your employees in some of these wellness programs, specifically the walking? Martha or Brad?
Yeah, so specific to our motion program that I spoke about earlier, so we don't delineate when those steps get taken throughout a day, so I would certainly say folks wearing it during their shift, that's going to help them, and depending upon what type of work they're doing, whether they're typically sitting at a desk or working in a mill, obviously could have two very different outcomes. So for people 10 to 12 hours a day, you want to make sure that, you know, they're bought in. And again, I don't take mine off. Do y'all ever take yours off except a shower? I mean,
I don't take off a shower.
I don't, because I want my 10,000 steps, by God. So yeah. if I'm going to the mailbox, I am getting my step credits. But I really think it becomes habitual, right? Just habitual for getting folks to either put it on their wrist or strap it on their waist. And you all may have had, you probably had more experience across a more diverse population with that.
So let me, I would suggest that you not look at a program like that as a wellness program as traditionally is thought of. And I would characterize it more as a health improvement program, right? I mean, that's what you're trying to do. So it's not, you know, fitness activities or, you know, water bottle challenges or, you know, healthy eating. Those are all kind of neat wellness things. But there's more very specific things in a health improvement program that wellness would fall under, you know, that you can implement regardless of your shift hours or location. Let me give you three examples. How many of you require your employee? What if you were to offer a program to your employees and you say, I'm going to offer you a lower premium, a lower contribution for you as an employee if you do three things for me. I want you to get an annual exam, I want you to do a health risk assessment, and I want you to do a biometric test, okay? It's a blood draw, some other biometrics they do, okay? All of those three things, if you do that, over the next 12 months, I'm going to require you to pay less for your premium, okay? Those are three health improvement, wellness-oriented activities. So you have your person go in for their annual visit, seeing a doctor. You'd be amazed at the number of your employees who do not see a doctor on a regular basis, probably don't even know a primary care physician, is going to the emergency room instead.
That's right.
And driving up costs that way. They're getting biometrics in terms of their vitals and their own blood and everything else. And they're doing a health risk assessment, which is a tool to help them assess their behavioral, their genetic, and just their behavior risk and what they can do about it. The number one thing that comes out of those three things is awareness. And it's amazing the number of times an employee comes out of a session, one of those three things, and learns about something they have, which is a life-threatening situation or potentially could be a life-threatening situation that they've identified and can manage at a much lower cost point than it would become episodic.
Yep.
Does that answer your question?
Yep. Okay. Well, I think we're at 3:31, so we've just hit our time, Max. I appreciate everybody's attention. I appreciate that I still see most of the room in here. Thanks for spending that time. We are going to go and convene at a round table, I guess, Linda. So Linda's going to walk us out here. Thanks again, everyone.